John chapter 18, we left off in verse 19. We're looking at the trial of Jesus in this section. And he goes up before a few authorities. He goes up before Annas. He stands up before Caiaphas. However, John does not cover that. Matthew covers that. John just kind of makes mention he went there, but doesn't really give any information about that particular trial. And then he goes before Pilate and gives the good testimony of his purpose in coming into the world. And then eventually, of course, we will see him crucified. But this is the trial. He's standing before some judges. But you got to wonder, as you're reading this, judging from the majesty that Jesus expresses in the composure, the self-control, in the wisdom, how he's totally self-possessed and understanding of what's going on, and while all of the authorities around him are clamoring to get what they want or to appease people or appease their particular personal needs, and they're all striving to get this man crucified, or at least from Pilate's standpoint, to get this man out of his hair because it's a political problem. They're all in this middle of this mess, but Jesus stands with just perfect composure. And you got to wonder, who's the judge? Who's the real judge? And you wonder also, when you read about the trial and the whole persecution of Jesus, that one day we'll stand before him, and of course, he will be our judge. Right now, however, we think we're at the judgment seat. We're going to decide, well, is he worthy of my following? Is he worthy of my belief? And we think we're making a judgment call on who Jesus is, but ultimately that will be the judgment call he will make. And we'll stand before him. Look at his perfect composure. A Jewish friend of mine once said to me that even if there was a strong case for Jesus to present himself as a Messiah, that he could not be the Messiah, because the official court decision was that he was a blasphemer. And so as a Jewish person, he felt he could not go against the official decision, which according to their law stands as final. It was an interesting point. If Jesus officially was condemned to be put to death as a result of blasphemy, then that would have been the official decision. But one must consider something, and you'll see it very clearly in these pages, and it's also borne out by a lot of the testimony of extra-biblical sources and history, that there was a lot of corruption about this trial. It was an illegal trial, really. In fact, we looked at last time the various laws that the people who were trying to put Jesus to death had to break in order to put him to death. It was a sham. It was a mockery of a trial. It was a mockery of justice. But we left off with Jesus being brought before Annas. Peter is kind of following along, and the drama kind of unfolds with Peter in his dilemma. As Jesus said, you would deny him. He would deny him three times before the rooster crow. And sure enough, Peter's already denied him twice. He's out there warming himself by the enemy's fire, and he's kind of putting himself in that position, just in the same way that so many Christians do these days. They put themselves in the wrong place. They're in a place they shouldn't be. In a place of temptation that they can't handle, that God hasn't given them the grace to handle, and yet they think they can handle it, and they go there, and then they fall flat on their face. And it's probably a necessary part of their development and growth, because that's, we all need to learn our own strength, the limitations we have, the extent of our strength. Well, verse 19 says, "The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine." Now notice he's before Annas. Previously, he's brought into the courtyard of the high priest. They brought him before Annas. He's standing before Annas. And the high priest, Annas, asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Problem with this question is, it's illegal. It's an illegal attempt to get Jesus to incriminate himself. That according to the law, the witnesses that have heard Jesus need to be brought forth, and then they will testify what he said and what he did. Now, a little bit about Annas from history. He was high priest from AD 6 to 15, officially. And then all of his sons held the priesthood, and Caiaphas actually is the legal high priest now. At least the Romans recognize Caiaphas. And it's interesting that Caiaphas, though he's the high priest, Annas is called the high priest, and that's because history bears out that Annas was the power behind it all. He was the one pulling the strings. the high priestly office was meant to be an office for life, but problem is it became an office that was borne by people because of bribery and contempt with the law and people that made deals with Rome. The highest bidder got it. And Annas' family, according to history, was extremely rich. How much of the money, you got to wonder, came from the concessions at the temple? Because their shops were called the Bazaars of Annas. Now, these very same shops were the ones that Jesus had issue with. Now, you can kind of get an understanding of what vested interest Annas has in putting Jesus out of the way. He took a financial hit. And you know, you touch people's wallets and you're going to get them pretty upset. You touch their money and look out. And of course, his vested interest was there. But his tactics of gaining money were quite corrupt. For example, if you were coming to the temple, and as you would come to bring your sacrifice, of course, you'd bring the best from your flocks. You'd pick out one of the little lambs, you know, from your flocks. And of course, it would be a reminder this innocent little lamb would have to suffer and die in your place because of your sin. So you're bringing your little lamb. You've picked out the best. No flaws in it as far as you can tell. But you had to go before these temple magistrates and they would examine officially your lamb. Now, they would conveniently find some little blemish that you didn't happen to notice. And they'd say, I'm sorry, you can't use this. In fact, it's really worthless here, so you might as well just take it. Well, you can't take that thing back with you. I mean, it's a hassle, and what are you going to do? So they would offer you a fraction, a small percentage of what it was worth, and you would sell it begrudgingly, and then they would turn around and sell you one of theirs at full value. It was a 60 to 90% profit-making scheme. But what was really going on, according to a few of the historians, was that they'd actually take your lamb and they'd recycle it. It would be the same lamb that someone else would buy. And they had this scheme going, and I tell you, they were making money hand over foot. So here they are. In the Talmud, it actually has a warning to the house of Annas. It says, woe to their serpent's hiss, their high priests, their sons are keepers of the treasure, their sons-in-laws are guardians of the temple, and their servants beat the people with staves. What a reputation to have among your own people. So it makes sense why he wanted to see Jesus put down. He put the squeeze on his family business, and he attacked Annas' vested interest. So therefore, he's now going to question Jesus, incriminate him. He, in his clever manipulation, is going to get Jesus to incriminate himself. But you know, I think he underestimates who Jesus is, of course. Jesus answered him, and perfectly in accordance with the law, he reminds him. He says, I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet. And in secret, I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said. Jesus was not being evasive. He was not being disrespectful. He's actually doing this perfectly in accordance with the law because the law is being broken. This is an illegal question. Jesus reminds him graciously of that by saying, you can't ask me. You've got to ask those who heard me. Well, the response to this gracious reminder of the law to this high priest is that when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, do you answer the high priest like that? Now, maybe the officer took his cue from Annas' kind of standing there with this dumb look on his face, like he didn't know how to respond to that. Here's this man who he just thinks is, you know, this uneducated guy, reminding him of the exact protocol in the court system. And it takes him, and he's kind of like startled. And I could see the officer there thinking, hey, you know, that ain't right. And so he smacks Jesus. And Jesus then, with perfect composure, says, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me? Now, he had a whole lot more patience than Paul the Apostle did when Paul the Apostle was in a similar situation, having to answer before a tribunal, and he answered something, and one of the servants struck him on the mouth, and Paul said this, he says, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, you know, for you judge me before the law, and you strike me, which is against the law, and that again was against the law. And it was equally wrong for Annas to not reprimand the officer or set that right. He, in fact, is in quite agreement with it, illegally. But Jesus had a whole lot more composure than Paul. And even afterwards, of course, Paul the Apostle, He apologized. Oh, I didn't know it was a high priest. You know, forgive me. It's wrong to speak evil against a ruler. But Jesus, perfect composure, Annas is dumbfounded. He doesn't know where to go with this. He doesn't know what to do with this. So it says that, verse 24, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now you got, again, John was quite aware of the situation. He's calling both of them high priest. That would have been crazy. There was really only one official high priest. But John knows who the real high priest was behind the scenes. Annas was the dude. He was the guy calling the shots. But he's got to be careful because Rome can't get wind of his secret dealings and his illegal trial at night. So finally, Annas says, well, I'm not getting anywhere here. So he sends him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. And therefore they said to him, now again, he's warming himself by the fire. And they says, you're not also one of his disciples, are you? And he denied it and said, I am not. And one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him whose ear Peter cut off, said, didn't I see you in the garden with him? And Peter then denied again. Now this servant would have obviously known that was Peter, relative. You know, he would have gotten the lowdown about the guy who cut his relative's ear off. But Peter denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. John just throws that in the middle here. I don't even know how to deal with this because it's a message into itself of Peter. There, Peter. Poor Peter. You know, there's so much here about Peter that I think we'll pick up later when he eventually comes around and he has the conversation with Jesus as Jesus restores him. And we'll definitely pick it up there. But there's a lot of thought in this just to consider where Peter was. Hours before, he's proclaiming, though every one of these other disciples don't follow you or scatter, I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to stand by you. And here he is now doing exactly what Jesus said he would do. I'd be kind of a bummer to hear that from Jesus to begin with, much less to be standing there having done it. Well, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. Now, the praetorium was really the what you would have called the whole area there before the Roman authority, before Pilate, the courtyard. And it's actually a courtyard whose stones that if you go into Israel today, the modern city is a number of layers above that. But they have dug down and you can go into these various places and you can stand on the various stones that would have been right there in the courtyard, the very same stones. In fact, they have found inscriptions and almost like tic-tac-toe where the soldiers would play games. There's a number of games there you can actually go and you could see on these stones, and probably the games that they would have been playing there while Jesus was being tried. Remember when they cast lots for his clothing? They probably played the little game. Whoever won the little tic-tac-toe like thing would win the prize or win whatever possessions that the criminal had. And this is it's interesting to go down there because it's just all of a sudden becomes like, whoa, this isn't just a storybook. This is like there. And when you're there in Israel, it's like it really becomes just something like, wow. I mean, you see where the part of the Antonio fortress there and the courtyard stones, and you see the cisterns that are there. And then you come up into kind of the unreal world of the modern day Israel. And it's like you just realize, where have I just been? This is amazing. This is rooted in history, the foundations of which, I mean, our nation, what are we, less than 300 years old, if you think about it. And over in Israel, you know, you go back histories of 5,000 years, just going back even to the time of David. But here now, at this place, it was early morning, and they themselves did not go to the praetorium, lest they should be defiled. You see, according to the law, they could not enter the dwelling place of a Gentile at any time. And on Passover, preparations would especially have required them to remove all leaven from their homes, which would have included them to be anywhere near a Gentile's home, because the possibility of picking up a little piece of crumb on your foot and carrying it home, which would have been leaven, you know, little yeast in the bread, you got a crumb on your foot and you just violated the law. Now, do you see the irony here? Here they have broken already almost every legal proceeding, the laws that they have stood in front of them. They're breaking them in order to get Jesus tried and put on the cross, but they dare not be defiled by stepping in this area. So they didn't go into the praetorium lest they be defiled, that they might eat the Passover. And Pilate then went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? Okay, what are the formal charges? You're bringing the guy to be judged. What are the charges? What has he done? Notice their answer. You know, they've already received kind of a blow with the high priest Annas. Then he sends him to Caiaphas. John does not talk about that, but that situation was kind of a dead-end street. Caiaphas has all kinds of issues and finally has to adjure him. I adjure you by the living God. Are you the Son of God? And Jesus, of course, confesses the good confession and says, I am. And you'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And he professed what who he was, that he was truly the Messiah. And of course, Caiaphas then says, what need do we have of witnesses now? And he tore his clothing, which was again another law that they broke. He should not have rended his garments at all. The high priest ripping his garments was against the law in that situation. And now they're determined to go. So in their minds, he's done. But they know they've got a problem. Blasphemy, which is what they've accused him of, which is the Caiaphas' official declaration of what he's done wrong. He has claimed, he's a man claiming to be God. That's why he was crucified. So often people don't really think that one through when they consider, in their opinion, what Jesus or who Jesus is. They say, well, I believe Jesus was a good man. I believe he was a good teacher. He was a prophet. You know, he was a guy that went around teaching lots of good things. The average person thinks that. Problem is, Jesus made a very clear claim to being God. That is very easy to see because that's exactly what he's accused of in his trial by Caiaphas. And he's accused of claiming to be, he's accused of being a man claiming to be God, which in their law was blasphemy. That was the official charge. Now, you have to understand, he claimed to be God. Now, I love kind of the trilemma that Josh McDowell puts out in his book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. If Jesus claimed to be God, which he did, very clearly, there's only two alternatives. It's either true or they're false. Either his claims were true or they're false. That's the only two alternatives you got. Now, if they were false, there are two alternatives. If Jesus claimed to be God but wasn't, there's only two alternatives. He either knew they were false or he didn't know they were false. He either knew they were false, which would make him what? A liar. If you're making a statement that you know is wrong, you're a liar. But if he made the claims and didn't know they were false, what would that make him? Crazy. Or, for the alliteration, lunatic. So those are the only two options if his claims are false. If he's not the Son of God, you've got to call him a liar or you've got to call him a lunatic. There's no middle ground. How could you call a man, a good man, who boldly claims to be God, claims that he can save you eternally, claims that he can forgive sin, claims that the whole world will one day bow before him, that he is the Son of God. I mean, how can you call that man, if he's not the Son of God, anything less than a liar or a lunatic? You can't call him a good man. So the only other alternative is that his claims are true. And if his claims are true, now you're going to be asked to make a decision. Will you honor that or will you not honor that? Will you put your trust in him as Lord or will you reject him? And so this is the dilemma. Now, he stands before Pilate and Pilate asks, what's the charge? Well, they can't say blasphemy. That would be like taking someone to a court and suing them because they are idolizing their car in our culture. Can you imagine? Your neighbor's out there every single day washing his car, driving. Oh, he loves this car. He's bragging about it. He's talking about it. And you're going to sue him and take him to court because he's making an idol of it. Now, would the court have any care about that? Would the court say, get out of here. It's a religious thing. We don't care about that. This is the same thing that the dilemma is. They realize if they say blasphemy, he's going to say, forget about it. So they try to be coy with it. Verse 30, it says, they answered and said, well, if he were not an evildoer, we wouldn't have delivered him up to you. I just love this. It's like, I can't believe they're saying this. It's like, well, just believe that we've got a reason for it, kind of. Well, Pilate said, you take him and judge him according to your law. And then the Jews said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Which was true. They lost that 10 years prior. The right of the sword they lost 10 years prior, and they cannot do this. Now, Pilate is in a pickle here because he's going to be pressured now politically, and he's vulnerable. Pilate's already made a number of mistakes in becoming the governor. When Herod the Great died in B.C. 4, he split the kingdom to his three sons, Antipas, Phyllis, and Archelaus. And Archelaus was a tyrant. Eventually, he was the one that was overseeing Judea and Samaria, and eventually he was disposed because he was a bad guy. The Jews wanted a governor. They wanted, hoping to be incorporated with the province of Syria so that Rome wouldn't really watch them that closely, because the provinces that were imperial had their troops required, but the ones that were senatorial, they didn't need troops. They were peaceful. So they were trying to maneuver in a way to get all the Roman troops out of town. Didn't work. Caesar set up a procurator over Judea and Samaria, and Pilate was the fellow at this time charged with that unfortunate duty. And the problem is, when he first came, he had no understanding. He didn't know anything about the Jewish people, their sensitivities or anything. And he comes in with these Roman standards, and the emblems of the Caesar on the top. And, of course, the Jewish people, they're very meticulous about their law, no images. They said, please take those images off those standards. They begged him. He wouldn't do it. 5 days, the Jewish zealots dogged his every step in Israel. Being very polite, being very, careful, would you please we can't live this way. We can't have those standards. Finally, he called him into the theater in Caesarea. And when we go to Israel, we go to this one of the theaters there in Caesarea. It's most likely it would have been the same theater because there's not too many theaters in Caesarea. And so he calls him into this area, and he surrounds them with troops, and he tells them if they don't stop bugging him about this, he's going to kill them all. You know what they did? They said, go ahead. They barred their necks and said, we're ready to die. Well, what do you do as a leader at this point? He capitulated. He gave in, so that's it. Eventually, then he did another dumb move. He took some of the temple gold to build an aqueduct. A lot of rioting, a lot of problems. So all these words are coming back to Caesar. His political future is in jeopardy, so he's vulnerable. And the Jewish people here, these leaders, know he's vulnerable. So they say, well, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Now, what they didn't realize, of course, is that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying what death he would die. Jesus said he would be what? Lifted up. He would be lifted up, which implies not a stoning, which is the typical way to kill someone who is blaspheming. That was what, when a person was convicted of blaspheming, the actual law prescribes that the witnesses come forth who saw him and were firsthand witnesses, and they're the first ones to pick up the stones, the first ones to throw it, and put to death that blasphemer. Well, they don't have the authority to do that anymore. However, later on, they do it with Stephen. It gets a little out of hand. I think they were much more cautious because it was Passover. Crowds were in Israel, Jerusalem at that time. Everybody was talking about how great Jesus was. Everybody was talking about how awesome this man of God was that just raised Lazarus from the dead and now has come in, and they were singing Hosanna. And so the Jewish leaders, they've got to get rid of him. But they can't do it publicly. They've got to do it secretly. And so they're trying to get this trial through really quickly. And so they know they can't stone him. So what they do is they want Pilate to be the bad guy. And it says, Pilate entered the praetorium again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? So he's gotten a little information. Somebody's told him something. And that seems to be something he might be able to settle this if he can get an answer from Jesus. So, that's insurrection. You can't be a king. You calling yourself a king? Sorry, we've got one king, Caesar. And, too bad for you, and he'll sign his death warrant. Jesus answered and said, are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me? Again, he is reminding Pilate now of the proper protocol in questioning a prisoner. Very shrewd. Not trying to avoid the question, rather just reminding Pilate of the law. Well, Pilate answers with the contempt, all the contempt that this very cruel man could come up with, Am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you up to me. What have you done? And Jesus answered. Now here's where it gets very clear. My kingdom is not of this world. He says, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. By the way, when you see constantly in John, the Jews, just keep in mind that he's referring to the leaders of the Jews, the representatives of the Jewish nation. Because John himself was Jewish. So he's not maligning Jewish people here. Throughout church history, the misunderstanding of this has been that, you know, Christianity maligns the Jewish people from this, you know, some of these gospels. But he's referencing the leaders of the Jews. Because John himself is Jewish. But he's talking about the leaders, and of course, Jesus himself is talking about the leaders. Jesus is Jewish. He said, I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now my kingdom is not from here. Well, Pilate therefore says to him, are you a king then? And Jesus answered, you say rightly that I am. Now, literally, it says, you say that I am. Now, in our culture, you know, that might be a way to avoid the clear statement. In that culture, it was just another way of saying, you've clearly spoken it. You've said it. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. And then he adds, everyone who hears, who is of the truth, hears my voice. You know, that statement right there bears a whole message in unto itself. The fact that when your heart is in the right place, you're going to know the truth. Jesus said, my sheep hear my voice and they follow me. He says, if anyone is willing to do God's will, he'll know of the teaching. That you can be assured that if you open your heart to the Lord, it's positive. It's proof that the Lord is now, you're one of his. Because if you're of the truth, you'll hear his voice. But only he can do that within your life. All we can do is appeal to God for a clean conscience. All we can do is cry out to God, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And he is the one that will open our ears unto the truth. Well, Pilate says to him, what is truth? I don't want to put any tone on that question, because it could be a number of things. He could be contemptuously saying, what is truth? Sarcastically saying, what is truth? He could be wistfully saying, what is truth? We don't really know. We can't tell. But we do know that what Pilate is facing, without even knowing it, is not only is he standing before one bearing witness to the truth, but he is standing before truth himself. And you know, truth will be our judge. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And every deed, every aspect of, you know, what has been done in our lives is going to be borne out. We will be naked and standing before naked and open before God, who sees our whole heart. He sees it all. Jesus is full of the truth. Jesus said that you'll know the truth when you're his disciple, and the truth will set you free. He testifies to the truth. And when he leads us, he sends what? The Spirit of truth. When he leaves this earth, he sends his disciples, the Spirit of truth, to come and be with them. And everyone, he says here, who is of the truth, hears my voice. Pilate, what is truth? It's interesting that if you survey Americans today and you ask them, what do they believe about religion? That the majority of Americans believe that all religions will ultimately lead to God. The majority of Americans, that they're all just different ways of getting to God, that God reveals himself in all religious traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, etc. Problem is, many of the religions of the world are mutually exclusive. Some have and show an impersonal God. Some show a personal God. Some show an afterlife. Some show no afterlife, but reincarnation. Some teach that, like Judaism teaches a personal deity, monotheism, but eternal life is earned, where Christianity, a personal deity with monotheism, but eternal life is a gift. When Buddha came 500 years before Christ, there was no pre-announcement. When Muhammad came 500 years after Christ, there was no announcement that he was coming. There was no prophecy about his appearing and what he would do and all sorts of things. He just showed up and did his thing. And then afterwards, people honored him as a great teacher. or honored Buddha as a great teacher. But when it comes to Jesus, he stands out head and shoulders above anyone that could even make a claim. In fact, none of these other teachers did make a claim to be God. Jesus made a very bold claim to be equal with the authority on high, that he is our creator and our redeemer, that he was there. The Son of God was there at the very beginning. He was there in Abraham's day. Before Abraham was, I am. But you know, the Old Testament prophesied over 300 times declaring the coming of this one and all the specifics in regarding what he would be like, what he would do. Very amazing prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. And if anyone were to come on the scene today and say, hey, I'm the Messiah, we would be able to say, okay, well, let's look at the criteria here. Check number one. Were you born in Bethlehem? Because the Messiah has to be born in Bethlehem. Only one out of 280,000 people in the world are born in Bethlehem. So that narrows the field somewhat. Then you had to be preceded by a messenger who would come, and he would be, and all the description of John the Baptist. You have to have a forerunner who comes before you. And then you have to be betrayed by a friend, and you have to have your hands and feet pierced and wounded and whipped and sold for 30 pieces of silver and be spit upon and beaten. And the betrayal money needs to be thrown in the temple and given for the potter's field. How are you going to control that one? Yeah, it's hard to control where you're born, too, by the way. That'd be a good trick. But you think about all these prophecies, the chances of anyone just by chance fulfilling them are so astronomical that it's beyond possibility. There, put it this way, there is not enough atoms in the entire universe to mix together and pick out one atom, which is about the same chance of these things being fulfilled by chance. It is so clear that Jesus is a Messiah from the prophecies alone, not to mention the works that he did and the historical evidence and the lives changed and so many other things. People who do not know anything about the Bible make foolish statements like, well, all religions eventually will lead to the same place. No, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. And we have to understand what Jesus is himself saying. I'm not pushing that in people's face. Jesus said it. I want to be a faithful steward of that. Now, again, in my expression of that, I'm going to be sensitive to where people are coming from. I'm not going to just go willy-nilly down the street. I'm going to look and preach it out loud in people's faces and so that it's an odious thing in their sight. Rather, I want to do what Paul the Apostle did. I want to pray for that effectual open door to tell people this gospel. Because it's one thing to speak it, but if people aren't hearing it because of presuppositions and maybe, you know, the way I'm coming off, I'm you know, pushing them away, then they're not going to hear it. But when they hear the gospel, when the gospel goes forth, it has the power to transform lives. And so I want to live in such a way that opens more doors, that this simple message of the gospel, that Jesus is the Son of God who loved us and died on the cross for us and rose again on the third day, you see, then it's very clear that truth is going to have that impact in their life. Well, he went out again to the Jews and said, I find no fault at all in him. But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews? And they all cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. And according to the other Gospels, he might have even been more than that, an insurrectionist, maybe a murderer. But John calls him here a robber. And it was a custom to release. Do you see what Pilate's doing? There's a little nervousness here. I don't think Pilate had any whit of a care about Jesus. I just think that he is just testing these Jewish leaders. He's been put upon by them one too many times. He doesn't like what they're doing. He doesn't care for it. And he's just being, again, his perfect cruel self either way. He's just playing mind games with them. So then Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Now the soldiers are doing this. He's now being scourged. Pilate scourges Jesus. Now, it's amazing how he just says it and we go on. But the scourging process was so incredibly cruel. Many, many people who experienced it went mad because of its torture. Some went unconscious, some died. literally, you take those cat of nine tails that those soldiers would use with the leather straps and the pieces of bone and glass tied at the end of it. And you'd stretch a guy out on a pole so his back was exposed. And you would take this with all your strength and whip that and then yank it down. And literally, by the third or fourth stroke, you see pieces of meat coming off the back. And can you imagine 39 stripes? The movies, I'm sorry, just don't cut it. They don't show that. They show a few little red marks on the back. And I'll tell you, his back would have looked like raw hamburger. And the blood loss would have weakened him so. But as they scourged him, then they put a crown of thorns upon his head. They put a purple robe on him and they said, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him." So he scourges him, but he's got no fault in him. Go figure. And Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Ecce Homo. In fact, that's what the place is, the little courtyard that you go into Israel. You go down, it's called Ecce Homo. Behold the man. And what does Pilate mean by this? You know, I think too many times we've put Pilate in a good light and like he's really impressed with Jesus at this point. I don't think he had the capacity to be impressed because of his background. I think, again, he is just doing this as a mockery to the people that have brought Jesus before him. Whether Jesus is guilty or innocent really matters not to him. He's not a man of principle by any means. But therefore, it says, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate said, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Again, he's not going to be put on by these guys. Now what the Jews do is they ply the political screws. He says, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." And therefore, when Pilate heard that he was the more afraid, he went out of the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Now he's terrified, not because of any other reason, other than Matthew tells us that Pilate's wife had a dream, came to him and said, "I had a dream concerning this guy. You better not deal with him." Now, Pilate may not have been principled, but he was extremely superstitious. So now he's really nervous when he hears that he's being called the Son of God. And now he's getting a little freaked out about this. And at this point, he's afraid. So he goes into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gives no answer. And Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you?" And Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." Is Pilate off the hook as a result of this? Not by any long shot. Pilate is a good case that you could see a lot of people in this man. That if all things were equal, he might give Jesus a chance. But he's got sin upon sin upon sin upon sin that has so twisted his mind, and the political pressure and the money and the position and all the stuff it's choked, as Jesus said, you know, the fruit. The seed has been there. The seed of the Word of God has been planted there. But what's happening very quickly is already it's gone because his heart is a hardened path. He's hardened himself so much against truth, against morality, integrity. And now he's standing before one who he thinks he's the judge, but all of a sudden you get the feeling like he's getting a little freaked out now. Maybe there's something more to this man. But Jesus said, "The one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." They're the ones that are breaking down the walls, but you know what? Rome still put Jesus to death. Yet the Jews delivered him up. They have the greater sin. Yet, what really put Jesus on the cross? Did anyone take Jesus' life, is what I'm saying. Who took his life? Can anyone take his life? What did Jesus say about that? "No one takes my life. I lay it down of my own will." No one took Jesus' life. You know, I have to say that when you look at the terminology some theologians have even used, the murder of Jesus, you have to be careful with that one, because maybe from their angle, yes, but not from God's angle. No one murdered Jesus. He laid his life down as a lamb led to the slaughter, purposely, because it was for God's purpose that he go to the cross that we might have life. Well, from then on, it said Pilate sought to release him. Now Pilate, again, is motivated more by superstition. He's terrified. He's afraid. He's got this wife telling him, stop and get rid of this guy. He's hearing Jesus with such majesty. He's seen many, many, many men break at a scourging. He's seen the open sobs and confessions come out. I did it, even if I didn't do it. I did it anyway, you know. He's seen it all. There's something about Jesus standing there with such majesty that just flips him out, especially when he hears that he's been called the Son of God. So he's trying now to get him off the hook. But the Jews cried out, saying, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. You see, now they're getting a little desperate. Now they realize, if Pilate's wavering on this and he gets off the hook, well, they'll have no recourse against Jesus at all. And they're terrified of their position. Caiaphas already said it's expedient that one man dies and not the whole nation. From his standpoint, if we don't get rid of him, we're going to lose our position. But what he didn't realize, he was prophesying that it was necessary that one man die for the whole nation. So they twist the facts now that Pilate would take the case, make it appear Jesus was involved in political insurrection and rebellion. And in doing so, do you know that they're denying their deepest beliefs and principles by saying we have no king but Caesar? In fact, this is really how it's put before him when he is questioned in the other gospel. We have no king but Caesar. Shall I crucify your king? We have no king but Caesar. Oh, well, he says it in the other gospel. He says it in verse 15 too. But I want you to notice something. In 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12, it says, when they saw Nahash, king of the Ammonites, come against them, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was your king. Samuel is reminding the people when they sought for a king to be over them, he told them, no, the Lord your God is your king. When they came into this theater, they understood that God was their king. They just played the political game with Rome, but they really didn't respect Rome. And when the Romans first came to Israel to take a census, to count the people, that was a bloody rebellion ensued because the Jews insisted God alone was their king. So now they're denying their very deepest held beliefs, all in a madness to crucify Jesus. Now again, do we see this saying? Let's not just look at these people in judgment and go, tisk, tisk, look at them. How could they have done that? We've got to let, this is really an indictment in ourselves. This is human nature, folks. The decisions you make and the choices you make set you up for other decisions and choices. The little sins that you let waft around your life will eventually be the foundation upon which bigger sins will be committed. And until it becomes such a complex web that eventually you'll find yourself doing things you never could have imagined. Interview the people there in prison. Ask them, when they were 6 and 7 years old, could they have ever seen themselves in that place? I could tell you that no, they couldn't. They were cute little kids running around like most. Maybe they had some tougher home situations, but they never had it in their heart to do the things that they were going to do later that put them in prison. In your own life, think about your own decisions you've made. When you were a little child, would you have ever imagined yourself doing that? See, how does it happen? What causes a person to get to this point where you're going to deny your deepest held beliefs just because of a temporary thing that you want? Where a man goes out and commits adultery against his wife, or a woman, her husband, and a person, a single person, is committing fornication because the rest of the world is doing it, and it's all we love each other type of thing, and we all have excuses and reasons, and it's sin upon sin upon sin. We get so tangled in it, it messes us up so much that we eventually find ourselves doing things we could never imagine. So we can't stand in judgment against them. When it says, Pilate therefore heard that saying, when he heard about the insurrection charge, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. For it was the preparation day of the Passover in about the 6th hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. And they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. And Pilate said, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered and said, we have no king but Caesar. And they delivered him to be crucified. And he took Jesus and led him away. You know, Pilate's scheme And in a number of ways, it appears that he knew Jesus was innocent. He was no threat to the Roman government. He was innocent of the charges. But he had to make a decision. John doesn't tell us about him sending him to Herod to try to get something and coming back. But that the other gospel records tell that Jesus went to Herod. Jesus was just silent before Herod. Herod had his chance with John the Baptist. Jesus had nothing to say to Herod. That's a sad thing, too, if you come to a point in your own life where the Lord has nothing to say to you because you've made your choice. But now Pilate, what is he going to do with all this? So he first thinks that, you know, maybe he can figure a way to get this out. So he's trying to release somebody else. Then he scourges Jesus to figure maybe that'll be enough. But now he realizes as the Pharisees, the Jews, the leaders of the Jews get drastic and appeal to Caesar, he realizes now there from his political vulnerability, he doesn't have a choice. But he only doesn't have a choice because of his sin. So we all have a choice. Sometimes we have to make some painful choices to do the right thing. Doing the right thing is not the easy thing to do. Sometimes you're going to be tempted with things that are wrong, and it'll tear every ounce of your being to do the right thing. But if you don't do the right thing, you're foolish, because it'll cost you a whole lot more in the end. And you won't be able to pay the price in the end. As I stand here and look at this judgment of Pilate, I realize who the judge really is. Annas is going to be judged for his actions. Caiaphas is going to stand before the living God. Pilate is going to stand before his judge. In fact, indeed did, but didn't know it here. And the decision that each of these made about Jesus is going to seal their eternal destiny, just in the same way the decision you make about Jesus tonight is going to seal your eternal destiny. Who do you say this man is? Now, most of you, I wager that you've already trusted Jesus as your Lord and Savior, but some of you haven't. And some of you may think you have, but you haven't really yielded the throne of your life to Him. You think you've said a prayer or you've done a religious duty and you're coming to church, and you're mistaken if you think it's anything that you're doing which is going to get you into eternal kingdom. It's yielding your will to the one who loved you. It's believing on him fully. It's turning from your sin and putting your trust fully in the Lord Jesus. That's eternal life. That's the way to eternal life. That is the only way, Jesus said. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through me.